The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, broadcasting for another hour inside the Trumpet Tower, the Tower of Power, the Loft on High, the Fortress in the Sky, the Ed Stone Dome. You listeners are out of control with the new names for this lovely new studio high above the Ed Stone facility. Here in the Midlands, the beautiful UK, wonderful evening last night, some open sports activities, basketball, soccer, just a beautiful time of year. And, of course, everything around here is much greener than it was 4 or 5 weeks ago. We've gotten more rain, not a lot of rain, but enough to turn things green once again. So, as I say, a beautiful time of year. But all of these emails, what am I to make of these name suggestions? One of you suggested Sam's office, which is kind of dull, but he likes that, judging by his reaction in there. But who would have thought that after more than 3 years of daily broadcast, the biggest email response by far comes from all of you pitching in to offer name ideas for the new studio. Well, on today's program, let's bring it to a more serious note. There's lots to get to. I'm going to get into the subject of history once again. I gave a lecture yesterday for all of the students at God's College about how that they're making history as well, that which we're engaged in day by day. I mean, we're living history, basically. Today's action is tomorrow's history, so we'll get into that in the second segment. But in the first segment, I think to set it up, all of the news yesterday, and surely it's going to dominate the American news cycle today, the convictions, the plea bargain, Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort. But before I get into some of the specifics there, I just want to give us some prophetic perspective. And we have to go back, as I've gone back to so many times, to the Saving America from the Radical Left, the article back in the, what was it, the May-June 2018 Trumpet magazine. And in that issue, my father talked about how the entire Trump-Russia investigation is based on a hoax. Okay, so that's the starting point from which we want to view all of these other twists and turns along the way. There's this hoax that it's all built up upon. This dossier, as my father said, all of the lies in that document. October 2016, how that the FBI and the Department of Justice, they presented this vile, deceitful dossier to the FISA courts so that they could begin spying on Donald Trump. They made up all of this dirt on the president of the United States, or then the candidate who was hoping to be president. And then you know the story. All of the warrants to surveil members of the Trump campaign. That included Paul Manafort, although his was in some ways separate and apart from Carter Page and Papadopoulos and some of those other players from 2016. As I say, we'll get to Manafort in just a second. But first, the perspective. It's based on this hoax, and they're supposedly looking for Russian collusion, Trump-Russian collusion, and they've been going now for a year and a half and have found exactly nothing. No collusion. But, as my father wrote, what has been revealed is a tremendous amount of lawbreaking by bureaucrats in intelligence and law enforcement. He said the previous president filled America's law enforcement agencies with treasonous agents He led what is known as the deep state. Something diabolical was going on until Mr. Trump was elected. And it's still going on behind the scenes during his presidency. So it's still happening. And irrespective of what you see from the daily news cycle, day by day, keep in mind that the ultimate target here is Donald Trump. It's not Paul Manafort. It's not Michael Cohen. It's not the Russians. I mean, they've moved on from that. They're going after the president of the United States. He is the prime target. Now, if you're actually watching what's happening, if you're looking at this from God's perspective, this attack on America's foundational institutions, then you see all of this lawbreaking and such that's being exposed. You see the conspiracy here, the conspiracy aimed at undermining Donald Trump. My father wrote the Nunez memo article the month before. This was from the April Trumpet magazine. And he said, now that Donald Trump is the president of the United States and is still a suspect in a criminal investigation, he's still a suspect, and there's no evidence to justify it, he went on to say. And he explained in that article, the media is all complicit. They're in on this lawless plot. They're trying everything that they can to give all of this nonsense credibility. And so, well, I'm not in America, but one can only imagine what today's news cycle will be like. Surely there will be those saying that this is it. This is the end of the road. Everything's caving in on Donald Trump. But step back for a moment, as I say, and get the perspective. So Paul Manafort, he was President Trump's campaign chairman for about, I think, 5 months in 2016. Yesterday, he's convicted on 8 charges revolving around tax and bank fraud, failing to disclose foreign bank accounts. And he could get up to 240 years in prison for these crimes. Those were 8 of the charges. The other 12, I think it was, the jury was deadlocked on those, or there's a hung jury. They couldn't decide one way or the other. But Paul Manafort, the case, what he's convicted of, it has nothing to do with the Trump-Russia investigation. No collusion. There's nothing in it about Russia, even. Now, that doesn't justify him breaking tax laws. But I think everyone who knows even the littlest about these details knows that if Paul Manafort had not spent those few months with the Trump campaign in 2016, he would not be in the predicament he's in today. I mean, that's just the truth. It doesn't mean that he should get away with breaking laws, tax laws, or hiding information from banks or hiding money, whatever it was. But the thing about it, I mean, all of these crimes that he's been convicted of, they all occurred years ago. Even before the Obama administration came along. In fact, the Obama DOJ knew all about it several years ago. But they didn't go after him. There wasn't enough evidence there, they said. But as soon as he becomes a member of the Trump campaign, as soon as Donald Trump hires him, he automatically becomes a massive target. I mean, that's the bigger story here. This is the bigger revelation. This reveals the real corruption that's deep-seated. It runs through the deep state. Byron York, he said in a column just today, again, saying what I mentioned a moment ago, that's not to say that the public did not learn anything from the Manafort trial. Indeed, if nothing else, outsiders got a glimpse into what Washington influence peddlers have gotten away with for decades. Manafort was convicted of shady dealing going back a long way. His behavior had been examined by the Obama Justice Department, which took no action against him. It was only because Manafort hooked up with Trump, and Trump then won the White House, And Democrats then pushed a Trump-Russia narrative to hobble the new president. And Trump then fired the director of the FBI only through all those circumstances that Manafort got caught and his foreign money schemes exposed. As I say, none of this is meant to excuse what he did, what he was convicted of. But none of this, none of these crimes have anything to do with what Bob Mueller is supposedly looking for. And he is looking for crimes. He is searching, and he has an unlimited budget. And he's going after anyone connected to or associated with Donald Trump and hoping to reel in Trump as the ultimate prize, the ultimate target. Byron York says Mueller's cheerleaders in politics and the press, he's got a lot of support among the Democrats, in the media. They will undoubtedly call the Manafort verdict a big win, but in the Trump-Russia 2016 election conspiracy investigation, a real big win would establish the existence of a Trump-Russia 2016 election conspiracy. I mean, isn't that what they're searching for? It says, and the Manafort verdict, like the earlier Mueller cases, doesn't do it. So where does Mueller go from here? Where does he go? Who is left? Well, there's Cohen, and we'll come to him in just a second. But here, Manafort, he was under criminal investigation in 2016. And Donald Trump, if you remember, he tweeted back in June of this year regarding that investigation that no one in the DOJ or the FBI told him about. He was being investigated in 2016, Manafort, and as Trump tweeted, as only one of two people left who could become president, so he's hearkening back to 2016 when he won the Republican nomination. He says, why wouldn't the FBI or the DOJ have told me that they were secretly investigating Paul Manafort on charges that were 10 years old and had been previously dropped during my campaign? Why didn't they tell me during my campaign? CNN, remember, they reported, I think it was in 2017, that Manafort had been surveilled. His phones had been tapped. That was going on in 2016, just as they were wiretapping Carter Page's phones as well, listening in to the Trump administration. And so Donald Trump's point is that if that was happening in 2016, then when I won the nomination, why didn't they tell me? I mean, I never would have hired him if I would have known he was under investigation. But that's just it. They weren't working. They weren't working in support of America and its institutions. They were working against Donald Trump. And so they kept it all on the down low. And Mr. Trump didn't know anything about it. He didn't know what they were doing with Carter Page. He didn't know what they were doing with the informant. It was all orchestrated by the deep state, as my father has written. He said in that Nunez article from April, the radical left has attempted to use the Russia investigation to cripple the Trump presidency. They don't just want to wrest control from Mr. Trump. They're trying to take control of the government forever. I mean, they're trying to cripple him and grab hold of power forever. They don't want to relinquish power. They were sure Hillary Clinton was going to win. She lost, and that turned their world upside down. And so now it's throw the book at the Trump administration. You never, ever hear of a lawyer or a representative or an assistant or someone from Hillary Clinton's administration or staff or Obama. That's the thing that so many people, at least half the people in America, see. It's not that a lot of people will rush to the defense of Paul Manafort's behavior. It's that they'll say, well, if you're going to go after him and try to put him in jail for 240 years, What about the lawyer who helped to scrub the servers of Hillary Clinton? What about the lawyer who helped her destroy evidence? Well, Michael Cohen, he was supposedly the fixer for Donald Trump. And yesterday, he pleaded guilty to 8 felony charges. It was all part of a plea bargain. 5 of the charges had to do with tax evasion. The 6th one, a false statement made in an application for a loan at a bank. And then the last two, and this is what gets the media hyper excited. Campaign finance violations. Here's where it's connected to Donald Trump. He's pleaded guilty now to violating campaign finance law. Here's what, let's start actually with clip 2, Sam, but this is what the lead prosecutor, Robert Kuzami, this is what he said yesterday after Cohen accepted the plea bargain and pleaded guilty. Clip 2.
What he did was he worked to pay money to silence 2 women who had information that he believed would be detrimental to the 2016 campaign and to the candidate and the campaign. In addition, Mr. Cohen sought reimbursement for that money by submitting invoices to the candidate's company, which were untrue and false. They indicated that the reimbursement was for services rendered for the year 2017, when in fact those invoices were a sham. He provided no legal services for the year 2017, and it was simply a means to obtain reimbursement for the unlawful campaign contribution.
So there's the prosecutor saying there was an unlawful campaign contribution. Cohen's admitted to this, and as part of the admission, he says that Mr. Trump made him do it. Pull that headline up again, Sam. Let me just say this from The Hill. Cohen's plea deal is prosecutor's attempt to set up Mr. Trump. That's at The Hill today, not exactly a right-wing publication. But this is all a setup. Why is this? He explained it in a pretty complicated way. Let me just read from, this is a column from the Epoch Times. I think this is in New York, this publication. But it says here, payments used to silence people who have potentially damaging information on a political candidate cannot be classified as a campaign contribution, according to the former chairman of the Federal Election Commission. This is the guy that used to be over the FEC, Bradley Smith. And he's saying if Mr. Trump did it with his own money. A non-disclosure agreement or a confidentiality agreement. Or if you're listening to the major media, it's hush money. They've got to do everything that they can to try to make Donald Trump look like he's doing something evil or unlawful. Of course, there's confidentiality agreements that just about every law firm in America is getting engaged in, if not daily, every few weeks, I would imagine. Certainly celebrities, politicians, congressmen. But this is the former FEC chairman. It says not everything that might benefit a candidate is a campaign expense. That's what Smith wrote. Bradley Smith wrote this for the Wall Street Journal back in April. He wrote at the time that the feds, remember, raided Cohen's home, his office, his hotel, his safety deposit box, everything. Stole his phones. Well, they didn't steal them, but they took them. They seized them. This op-ed at Epoch, it says here, if the same loose interpretation of campaign finance laws were applied to Trump's opponent in the election, Hillary Clinton, charitable spending by the Clinton Foundation could be viewed as benefiting her candidacy and would have to be considered a campaign expense, Bradley pointed out. I mean, if you're going to apply this standard, if you're going to say there's laws here that are being broken, then what about just applying the same standard to the other side? It's not happening. There's 2 different standards. Never mind what this prosecutor said yesterday. I'll play another clip here in just a second. But there's a double standard. And you see it clearly with the Manafort case. 4 or 5 years ago, what he did didn't matter. Not worth prosecuting. Too expensive. whatever the excuses might have been, as soon as he joins Trump, he's a target. He's the center of the investigation. This obviously means Trump is up to some kind of evil shenanigans. It says many ardent anti-Trumpers sincerely believe that the president is a threat to the rule of law. The real threat, listen to this. This is from an op-ed just today, the Epoch Times in New York. The real threat to the rule of law, however, comes from abusing laws to get a political opponent. That's the real threat here. And again, we're not going to justify any kind of lawbreaking. If the law says you've got to pay taxes, you've got to pay taxes. And if you go in and sign an application and want to get a loan and you leave off critical information that would have prevented you from getting the loan, it's illegal. If you lie under oath, if you lie to the FBI. But what if you abuse the laws at the very highest levels of government to get a political opponent? That's what's happening. And again, if you go back to those two issues, the April issue of the Trumpet magazine and then the May-June issue, this gives you all the context that you need to understand the ever-changing narrative that you see in the daily news cycle. Mark Levin last night, he's the radio show host on Fox News. He talked about this same point that was brought out in the op-ed that I just read there. Here's clip four.
Lanny Davis, he had his client plead to two counts of criminality that don't exist. These campaign finance violations that all over TV, they're saying, implicates the president of the United States directly. First, let's back up. It is a guilty plea. It is a plea bargain between a prosecutor and a criminal. A criminal who doesn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison. That is not precedent. That applies only to that specific case. Nobody cites plea bargains for precedent. That's number one. Number two, just because a prosecutor says that somebody violated a campaign law doesn't make it so. He's not the judge. He's not the jury. We didn't adjudicate anything. It never went to court. That's number two. A campaign expenditure under our federal campaign laws is an expenditure solely for campaign activity. A candidate who spends his own money or even corporate money for an event that occurred not as a result of the campaign, it is not a campaign expenditure.
And that's what the Hill article brings out, that last statement that he makes there. The candidate who's using his own money to settle a dispute or to make a non-disclosure agreement with someone, a confidentiality agreement. Now, the prosecutor, he comes out yesterday. He's got the big statement, 6-7 minutes. He doesn't take any questions, but he comes out and says, Michael Cohen has admitted, he has admitted to breaking campaign financing laws, and Donald Trump made him do it. That was from the statement yesterday. Here's what Powerline.com has to say. The fact that Cohen entered this guilty plea doesn't mean he actually broke campaign finance laws. See, that's what Levin was getting at. This is just some prosecutor stating his opinion. It wasn't the judge who made this determination. It wasn't a jury. It says here, there is a substantial argument that the payments to this woman, I forget her real name, and the other woman weren't crimes. Further on, he says, Cohen simply decided not to contest the campaign finance count against him in order to avoid major prison time for violations he apparently couldn't plausibly contest. Tax evasion and bank fraud. These are violations that, unlike the election law count, carry severe sentences. So, why is it then that among these eight convictions, or these eight felonies, six of them having to do with tax fraud and so, I mean, some that would carry awfully big penalties along with them, why are these two campaign finance violations tacked on, and why is that at the center of the prosecutor's statement yesterday? Why is that part of the plea bargain? Why did they have to get Cohen to confess to these lesser violations that never get punished? Not these days, anyway. Well, unless you're a Republican. Well, it's because their underlying objective here is to get to Donald Trump. They're going after Donald Trump. He's the target. He's the president they're wanting to bring down. And more, I think you're beginning to see that they can't do it in the courts. And so their aim is now to impeach him. And they've got a lot riding on the November elections. Here's another bit from the prosecutor, the lead prosecutor in the Cohen case yesterday, clip one.
In addition, Mr. Cohen pled guilty to two campaign finance charges, one for causing an unlawful corporate contribution, and a second one for personally making an excessive personal contribution, both for the purpose of influencing the 2016 election.
Both for the purpose of influencing the 2016 election. Initially, it was Russians influencing the 2016 election. Couldn't get any evidence of that. No evidence of collusion. And so here they are, straining at the net, trying to find any and every way that they can to tie in President Trump to illegally, the way they're presenting it, to illegally influence the 2016 election. Powerline says, Cohen's admission on the campaign contribution count has no legal force except as to Cohen. It doesn't apply to Trump, though it's quite possible that Cohen will provide testimony the prosecutors can use to argue that Trump violated the law under their theory of it. I mean, they may try to get Cohen to flip, I mean, if he hasn't already, so that he can then be a witness in going after Donald Trump. But when you start putting what he's said in the plea agreement together with all the things that he said a year ago or several months ago when he was defending Donald Trump, he doesn't exactly come through all of that as a very credible witness. I mean, even the prosecutor yesterday said he's a liar. He's a liar, and what he's done is serious. Well, when he got to the end of his statement, the lead prosecutor then proceeded to lecture America about just how wonderful the government is, the deep state. He didn't use those terms, but how that we're a nation of laws, and I mean nobody's above the law. Here's what he had to say, clip three.
We are a nation of laws, and the essence of what this case is about is justice, and that is an equal playing field for all persons in the eyes of the law, and that is a lesson that Mr. Cohen learned today, and it is a very harsh one for him.
And, of course, every single supporter of Donald Trump would probably shout at their TV screen at that moment and say, equal playing field? Are you serious? Not hardly. In 2008, the Obama administration committed over $2 million worth of campaign violations. Did Eric Holder go after anyone in the Obama administration? Were they making plea bargains with anyone connected to Barack Obama? Was anyone in the Obama administration confessing to felonies? These are serious. That's what the prosecutor said yesterday. I mean, this is serious. And Mr. Cohen, he's learned today because of this harsh penalty. It never happened in 2008. Or when it was uncovered, I guess, in 2011 or 12. Eric Holder's Justice Department, I mean, they slap a little fine, the FEC, fine, and then that's it. No felonies. Nobody goes to jail. Nobody's home is raided. Nobody's hotel is raided. Nobody's office space is raided. It's not an equal playing field. That's the point of saving America from the radical left. That's what you see when you look at the Nunes memo from a few months ago. It is not an equal playing field. And so you have both sides. I know there's no solution to this except for Jesus Christ's return, but you have both sides just digging in their heels. It's going to be fascinating to see how the election season plays out. Here's how the lead prosecutor concluded his remarks yesterday, thanking everyone that's involved with the federal government's prosecution of Michael Cohen. Clip 5.
I really want to thank Mr. Sweeney and James Robnett of the FBI and the IRS and the agents who work for them. We do many, many cases with them, and their determination and their fair dealing and their vigor with which they pursue their cases is really inspirational. To the prosecutors in my office, I cannot express the gratitude for the hard work that they did in this case. And that is Assistant United States Attorneys Andrea Griswold and Nick Roos and Rachel Maiman and Tom McKay, as well as Ed Discant, the Deputy Chief of the Public Corruption Unit, and Russell Capone, the Chief of the Public Corruption Unit. For all of these people, I could go on and on about their many virtues and talents. But the one important thing is they all are satisfied with simply being known as public servants, prosecutors, and law enforcement agents who are doing their job. Thank you very much.
And there he was, just echoing what the Obama administration said, the outgoing administration back in 2016, 2017, and what they've said since then, that, hey, I mean, anything we were putting in place, we were doing everything by the book. Even as they were setting up the incoming president, they were setting him up to fail. And they've been working at it for a year and a half, trying to take him down. And like my father said in Saving America, this particular president happens to be one that's fighting back. He's fighting back in ways that others have never fought back. And it is something to behold. But all this corruption on such a deep level, as my father said in that article, so deep that most people won't even believe it. They're just going to believe what the mainstream media, what they say today. They'll believe what they say about how bad this is and how that this is the end of this and this is the worst day of the presidency and so on and so forth. But get grounded in those two articles. There's a reason we keep coming back to them. And of course, if you step away from all of this back and forth, you think of prophecies like in Isaiah 59, where it says that all of us, all together, right and left, anyone in between, we're groping for the wall like blind men. We grope as if we had no eyes. We're stumbling around in the middle of noontime. Herbert Armstrong wrote in the Wonderful World Tomorrow book, "Today, as in ancient times, too many of those who seek offices of power over the people of cities, states, districts, or nations promise great benefits, pose as public benefactors. Why, we're just here to help you. We're here as your servants. I could go on and on about the virtues and the talents of everyone working in this prosecution office that was handed this case from the Mueller investigation team. I mean, the talents and the virtues all around us. We're here for you, public servants, prosecutors, law enforcement agents. We're just doing our job. It's an equal playing field." Well, more and more Americans are waking up to the fact that it's far from that, and that the corruption in the deep state truly does run deep. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Many modern historians today, they try to make great events in history. They try to make that the major theme of their textbooks. And yet, time and time again, you see this in the Bible through and through. But there's example after example of great men and women of history who dominate world events, who shape those world events, who influence those events in one direction or the other. Winston Churchill, following the First World War, he wrote a history of that war, and then in part of that, or as part of it, he included commentary of how he felt the war should have been fought, how the leaders involved should have waged war. He talked about what might have been had there been different leadership, had there been different strategies employed by those leaders. And then, of course, following World War II, in writing about that, Churchill said this was a war that was completely unnecessary. It could have been avoided. Think about how different that history might have played out had Winston Churchill been Prime Minister of Britain when Hitler came to power in 1933. If there was someone there to stand up to Hitler in 1936, in 1937 or 38, think about what one individual can do if he's a dynamic, confident leader like Churchill was. You look into the Bible and you see, as I say, you see examples of, well, if you give a righteous man a certain amount of godly authority, that man can actually change the course of history. My father, again, he wrote in that article I just quoted from in the first segment, The Saving America from the Radical Left, he talked about the two courses America's been on over the past 10 years or so, and how that for 8 years you had an Antiochus administration undermining the foundational documents of the United States of America, and then the succeeding administration, I mean, you talk about two different directions. Neither one of them are righteous in the biblical sense. But clearly, I mean, you see two different directions. And you see these two parties, they're still fighting against each other. They have such different views. But again, like the point that he made is, look at the different direction that we have now in the last year and a half, just because of a different leader. Look into the Bible and look at the examples of Noah, these biblical leaders, Abraham, Moses, Joshua. Look at the impact that they had, not just on the people around them or close to them, but look at the impact that they had on nations even, on the world. You can have a great impact on God's work if you walk with God like Noah did. I mean, God's building a family empire here. God's about to establish his kingdom on earth. Look at an example in Judges. This is Judges chapter 2 and verse 10. It says, and also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Eternal, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal and served Balaam, and they forsook the Eternal their God, or the God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt and followed other gods. They forsook God, it says later, and served Baal and Ashtaroth. I mean, they went from obeying God's commandments and statutes and going to instead worshiping the pagan goddess Ashtaroth and Baal, and that happened in just one generation. Moses, righteous leader. Joshua followed in his steps, a righteous leader. And then as soon as Joshua died, they started making the worst kind of history you could imagine. They stopped keeping the holy days. They stopped obeying God's laws. And they turned instead to Baal and to Ashtaroth. They had such a remarkable beginning. They had such a wonderful start. Such righteous leadership. But look at how quickly they turned away. I mentioned to the students yesterday the example of Herbert Armstrong and his wife going back to the late 1920s, how that they both kept the Feast of Tabernacles, God's holy days, faithfully. They kept it faithfully, those commands, for 7 years, and they didn't even understand the meaning. They didn't understand why. They just knew that God's word commanded it, and so they did it. And God started to raise up the Philadelphia era of his church and those early pioneers in that era, in that church. They came along, and for years, I think it was 12 years before they understood the meaning of these holy days, just a handful of people keeping the Feast of Tabernacles without really knowing why. And no doubt wondering, why are we keeping this? Well, they were keeping it, of course, because they were obedient. But do you suppose at the time they were thinking, wow, we're making history? I mean, this is changing the world. Eventually, there's going to be tens of thousands of people keeping these festivals all over the world along with us. Well, Mr. Armstrong might have thought that way, but I would imagine most of those brethren thought, boy, there's just so few of us, and we're keeping it in homes, and we don't even understand why. Well, in the late 1950s, there was something like 10,000 people observing the feast worldwide in the Worldwide Church of God. And by this point, I mean, they understood that the Feast of Tabernacles, that it pictured the millennium, when God's kingdom reigns over all the earth. That was in the 50s. There were 70,000 people keeping the feast in 1970. Attendance actually peaked at over 100,000, something like 120,000 in the mid-1980s. So you look back at that small beginning, that mustard seed beginning, Zechariah 4:9, don't despise the day of small beginnings. But back in the late 1920s, when it was just Herbert Armstrong and his wife Loma keeping the Feast of Tabernacles by themselves, they were making history. They had an impact on people all over the world. How important is it to go back to the beginning, to go back to the small beginnings? Whether you're looking at it spiritually or physically, our nations, our founding documents in the case of the United States, the British Empire, you go back to the beginning, and what a wise counselor you have. in those foundational documents, in that foundational law, those laws and statutes that come from God, and that in the case of Herbert Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God, that made that church great over and again throughout the Bible, God warns us to remember Mr. Armstrong. He was saying in the last year of his life, he wrote in that June 24th Worldwide News, this is 1985, he said, "I want you, brethren, to think about and understand what happened to God's church in the 1970s, lest history repeat itself. I want you to see the fruits of rebellion against God's way and God's government. During the 1970s, they were turning away from the truth. They were stabbing Mr. Armstrong in the back. They were doing away with the foundational teachings of the church when Mr. Armstrong was traveling the world, meeting with world leaders for something like 300 days a year. They were plotting behind his back. They were conspiring. They were anxious for him to die so that they could take over the church. Well, Mr. Armstrong got the church back on track. And then as he was warning there in the last year of his life, he's saying, brethren, you better remember your history. You better remember the recent history of the Philadelphia Church of God, or the Philadelphia era of the church. Otherwise, the 1970s history is going to repeat itself. And well, it did. It did. Those people forgot their history. They forgot those small beginnings. They forgot that they were brought into this to continue making history in the same way that Herbert Armstrong had made history. Look over at Ezra in chapter 7. Ezra 7 and verse 6, it says, "This Ezra, he went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which the eternal God of Israel had given, and the king granted him all his request according to the hand of the eternal his God upon him." He was a great student of God's law. He got back into the law of God. And over and again, when you see that happening, the days of Josiah, remember, when they discovered the text or a copy of the law, and then they pulled it out and they started to go through it again, and they're weeping. They're crying out to God in prayers of thanksgiving. We've got to get back to this. This is what made us great to begin with. Well, verse 10 says, "For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of God and to do it and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments." We've got to prepare our hearts to seek God. We've got to put in our time and get grounded in study. My son was telling me yesterday, he's just trying to read the Bible straight through as part of his daily Bible study, three chapters a day. He's in the book of Deuteronomy right now, and of course you think of Deuteronomy and you think of the Ten Commandments and you think of this as the book of the law. And in fact, Deuteronomy is a collection of sermons that Moses gave to the Israelites there toward the end of their 40 years of wandering. And over and again, like my son was saying yesterday, God was telling the Israelites to remember. Don't you forget these lessons that we've learned out here in the wilderness. You get back to that history. You keep making history the way that we made history when we came out of Egypt. You follow in those steps of Joshua, who follows in my steps, Moses would say. And then you'll make history. You'll continue making history. Winston Churchill, he was quoted as saying, "Why do we regard history as of the past and forget that we are making it?" We're making history. Tomorrow's history is the action that you're taking today, right now. Action this day. That was the theme for our camp, as I said a few weeks back. Today's action is tomorrow's history. That's why we're making history. And what kind of history are we making? Are we following in the steps of Moses and Joshua, Herbert Armstrong, these towering figures that really had an impact, a positive impact on the world, on the church, on the congregation? Or are we repeating some of the mistakes of history? They're also recorded in the history books, in the Bible, in that June 24th, 1985 worldwide news. Brethren, I want you to think about that history from the 1970s so that it doesn't repeat itself. Let's finish over in Nehemiah 8. This is, again, Nehemiah 8, part of the same history, the same story from that Ezra-Nehemiah period, the time of the restoration, the raising of the ruins, rebuilding the temple. Nehemiah 8 and verse 14, it says, "And they found written in the law which the Eternal had commanded by Moses that the children of Israel should dwell in booths in the feast of the seventh month, and that they should publish and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, Go forth unto the mount and fetch olive branches and pine branches and myrtle branches and palm branches and branches of thick trees to make booths, as it is written." So they found it in God's word that, well, we're supposed to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, just like Mr. Armstrong discovered this back in the 1920s. Oh, we're supposed to observe these days. These are commanded assemblies. So I've got to do it. I've got to do it even if it's just me doing it. I've got to do it even if I don't understand the meaning yet. And that's what he did. That's what they did back in the times of Nehemiah and Ezra here. Verse 16, it says, "So the people went forth and brought them and made themselves booths, everyone upon the roof of his house and in their courts and in the courts of the house of God and in the street of the water gate and in the street of the gate of Ephraim. And all the congregation of them that were come again out of the captivity made booths and sat under the booths. For since the days of Joshua," it says here, "Joshua the son of Nun, unto the day had not the children of Israel done so." I mean, they had not kept the feast like this since the days of Joshua. And it goes on and talks about how much rejoicing there was. They were reading from the book of the law of God. They were keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. They were obeying God's statutes and judgments. Well, you go back to the days of Joshua. I mean, that's around about 1400 B.C., and Ezra and Nehemiah, they're commenting on a time that was something like 900 years later. As my father wrote in an article years ago, it had been almost 900 years since Israel had kept such a wonderful feast. They were making history, the kind of history we all want to make. The history that takes us back to the beginning, that takes us back to origins, that takes us back to the God who established the Feast of Tabernacles and who commanded that we observe that feast. That's the kind of history that we want to make. My father has said years ago that we're not here just to teach. I mean, that's part of the training. We're going to be teaching the whole world God's ways, God's truth. But he said, we're not here just to teach. We're here to make history. And if you've been involved in this work for very long, you've been part of that story. The history-making victory that we had in court back in 2003, breaking ground on that headquarters property in 2001, or 2000, I guess it was, and then the college opening in 2001, breaking ground on God's house in 2008. All kinds of events along the way. But God has worked through human beings. He's shaped those events through his family government. That's what you and I are a part of. in the history of God's Feast of Tabernacles, my father wrote, this is from 2008, he said, can you imagine the book of Acts? We're going through this right now in Epistles of Paul class, the middle of Acts. It's a book of history. It's an incomplete history, in fact. He says, can you imagine the book of Acts leaving out the PCG history in the Laodicean era? My father says, we will be included. I tell you, the PCG is making Bible history. Jesus Christ, he said, is leading us into a great historical moment. And so when you think about history, when you think about your history, think about the history that you're making, even right now. Think about this great historical moment. Think about this work, this church that you support, and how it's making not just any old history, Bible history. It's pretty amazing. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We thank you for joining us yet again on today's program, and we'll look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.